Državni ispitni centar.
Maturità generale 2012.
Prova d'ascolto.
A tutti voi un cordiale saluto. Siamo all'inizio della prova d'ascolto d'inglese.
Questa prova d'esame si compone di due parti, la parte A e la parte B. Per ciascuna parte ascolterete un testo e risponderete poi a un esercizio che a esso si ricollega. Dapprima leggerete l'esercizio, poi ascolterete ciascun testo per due volte e risolverete l'esercizio durante l'ascolto. L'inizio e la fine del testo saranno indicati dal seguente segnale acustico.
Scrivete le vostre risposte negli spazi appositamente previsti all'interno della prova, utilizzando la penna stilografica o la penna a sfera. Scrivete in modo leggibile e ortograficamente corretto. In caso di errore, tracciate un segno sulla risposta scorretta e scrivete accanto ad essa quella corretta. Alle risposte e alle correzioni scritte in modo illeggibile verranno assegnati 0 punti.
Abbiate fiducia in voi stessi e nelle vostre capacità. Vi auguriamo buon lavoro.
Ascoltate con attenzione. Aprite la prova d'esame.
Section A. You will hear an interview with Danny Mimone, a hot air balloonist. You will hear the recording twice. Now read the task.
Danny, welcome to the program. And how and when did you get to become a professional pilot?
I actually got my license a long time ago in 1981 when I was 21 years old. Mm-hmm. And I came about that because I met two guys in a pub, strangely, who were the local hot air balloon pilots and exchanged some photographs for a first flight in a balloon and got hooked.
I mean, how do you become a professional and who pays you to do what for most of us would just be an exciting hobby?
Well, these days it's strictly governed by the CAA, so...
Civil Aviation Authority,
yeah. And it's a bit like fixed wing. You have to take air law, meteorology, navigation, all sorts of exams. You have to do so many flying hours with an instructor, and then you have to do a solo flight, and that's basically how you qualify.
And what were you doing initially when once you'd qualified? What trips were you taking people?
Well, being a professional balloon pilot involves flying passengers, so you're getting paid by companies, really, that hire you to fly passengers on special trips, champagne balloon flights, or you fly advertising balloons in various locations to promote somebody's product, like Nimble Bread.
which was so inspirational, that. Exactly. I remember watching it as a kid and thinking, I want to get off in that balloon.
Me too.
Now, how did you get to be flying over the Masai Mara? What took you to Kenya?
Well, I'd been flying for quite some time and I'd flown in various countries around the world, but I had this friend called Robin Batchelor, who's very well known in ballooning world, mm-hmm. who's done lots of ballooning adventures and things, and he had been to Africa and came back and he would go, Danny, you've got to go ballooning in Africa. It's just brilliant. You know, you can hear the lions at night roaring when you're in your tent, and it's just a magical way to see the wildlife. And I was always inspired by that. And one day I heard about a job going in Africa and I thought, OK, I'm going to apply and just see if I can get there. And I phoned up this guy at Cameron Balloons in Bristol and said, hey, Phil, I hear there's the opportunity of flying balloons in Africa. And he said, yep, I'll have a word with the guy for you. Next thing I knew, he was on the phone going, when would you like to come?
Wow. And so what was it like? I mean, what was the setup there that you moved
well,
into?
It was a bit crazy because I had my son with me. He was only 5 at the time.
Oh.
So I wasn't just going on my own adventure. I was dragging him along as well. And we got there and we had to take a conversion exam, which was quite interesting because we had to take an exam that really appealed to aviation pilots. So it was, if you're taxiing along a runway at night, which lights do you need to go left? Which was a bit of a tricky one, being a balloonist. And then we were based out in Kika Rock in the Masai Mara, which is where they have a safari tourist lodge. And then we had a separate base down in Taita Hills, which is about 3 hours north of Mombasa. And that was very different because it was just me on my own with my son, whereas in the Mara there was quite a group of pilots, and we didn't have a pilot house there, so we were in a tent actually for the first 10 weeks. And I remember standing with my son on the grass airstrip, waving goodbye to the pilot that had dropped us off in the light aircraft, and thinking, what am I doing here? I must be mad.
Now you will hear the recording again.
Danny, welcome to the programme. And how and when did you get to become a professional pilot?
I actually got my licence a long time ago in 1981 when I was 21 years old. Mm-hmm. And I came about that because I met two guys in a pub, strangely, who were the local hot air balloon pilots, and exchanged some photographs for a first flight in a balloon and got hooked.
I mean, how do you become a professional, and who pays you to do what for most of us would just be an exciting hobby?
Well, these days it's strictly governed by the CAA.
Civil Aviation Authority,
yeah. And it's a bit like fixed wing. You have to take air law, meteorology, navigation, all sorts of exams. You have to do so many flying hours with an instructor, and then you have to do a solo flight, and that's basically how you qualify.
And what were you doing initially once you'd qualified? What trips were you taking people?
Well, being a professional balloon pilot involves flying passengers, so you're getting paid by companies, really, that hire you to fly passengers on special trips, champagne balloon flights, or you fly advertising balloons in various locations to promote somebody's product, like Nimble Bread.
which was so inspirational. That exactly. I remember watching it as a kid and thinking, I want to go up in that balloon.
Me too.
Now, how did you get to be flying over the Masai Mara? What took you to Kenya?
Well, I'd been flying for quite some time, and I'd flown in various countries around the world. But I had this friend called Robin Batchelor, who's very well known in ballooning world, mm-hmm. who's done lots of ballooning adventures and things. And he had been to Africa and came back, and he would go, Danny, you've got to go ballooning in Africa. It's just brilliant. You know, you can hear the lions at night roaring when you're in your tent, and it's just a magical way to see the wildlife. And I was always inspired by that. And one day I heard about a job going in Africa, and I thought, OK, I'm going to apply and just see if I can get there. And I phoned up this guy at Cameron Balloons in Bristol and said, hey, Phil, I hear there's the opportunity of flying balloons in Africa. And he said, yep, I'll have a word with the guy for you. Next thing I knew, he was on the phone going, when would you like to come?
Wow. And so what was it like? I mean, what was the setup there that you moved
into?
Well,
it was a bit crazy because I had my son with me. He was only five at the time.
Oh.
So I wasn't just going on my own adventure. I was dragging him along as well. We got there and we had to take a conversion exam, which was quite interesting because we had to take an exam that really appealed to aviation pilots. So it was, if you're taxiing along a runway at night, which lights do you need to go left? Which was a bit of a tricky one, being a balloonist. And then we were based out in Kika Rock in the Masai Mara, which is where they have a safari tourist lodge. And then we had a separate base down in Taita Hills, which is about 3 hours north of Mombasa. And that was very different because it was just me on my own with my son, whereas in the Mara there was quite a group of pilots, and we didn't have a pilot house there, so we were in a tent actually for the first 10 weeks. And I remember standing with my son on the grass airstrip, waving goodbye to the pilot that had dropped us off in the light aircraft, and thinking, what am I doing here? I must be mad.
This is the end of Section A. Section B. You will hear an interview with a woman who suffered from severe brain hemorrhage. You will hear the recording twice. Now read the task.
Just had this very sudden, sharp shooting pain up the middle of my forehead and a very sort of strange kind of popping sensation behind my eye. The way I've sort of learned to describe it to myself now is really it's like sort of someone squashing a grape just behind my eye. That's exactly kind of what it felt like.
So what did you think had happened?
I didn't know. I just knew that something was, you know, sort of going wrong, really. I've never had a migraine, I don't think, in my life. So not being a migraine sufferer, I don't think I could identify that it wasn't a migraine. So I think that was my initial thought, really, was, oh, blimey, am I having my first, you know, migraine here? Is that what's going on?
How long did you leave it before you went to see a doctor?
Well, I took myself to bed that weekend. This was on the Thursday night that it first happened. And I just remember sort of thinking, oh, I just need to have a few days rest. And I did. But then on the Tuesday, I just kind of thought, oh, pull yourself together, come on, it's only a headache. And I kind of got on with my life, really, for a week.
So you'd been having these terrible headaches for more than a week?
Yeah, in the week itself, when I got back to work, I didn't have any sort of shooting pain headaches, actually. I just felt quite groggy. But yeah, I did a lot that week. I went to the dentist and had injections, actually, in my mouth, which is quite dangerous, I think, with a brain hemorrhage. But I obviously didn't know that I had one at the time. But the following Friday, I had another very bad headache, and that was the kind of the beginning of me really going downhill.
When you went to the doctor, how quickly did they work out that something very serious had happened to you?
Well, when I went to Derby Royal Hospital, I went to A&E, and at that point, I remember I couldn't even sit up. I actually lay on the floor in A&E. A nurse kind of looked at my eye, and that's where the bleed was behind my eye, so it was sort of squashing the nerve behind my right eye, and that was a real sign that something was going on. And they put me straight into a scanner, and then I had an angiogram, which is where they inject lots of dye in you so they can see if any blood's escaping. And then that was it. I was straight into an ambulance up to the neurological ward in Sheffield.
What were you told about your chances of survival?
A lot of doctors came to explain the chances to me that during the operation there was a very, very good chance that I would bleed out and die, that, you know, or that they might not be able to fix it anyway. I think it was one of those operations that they couldn't tell me my chances until they kind of got inside my head, so to speak, to really see, you know, what the bleed was looking like and the shape of this burst blood vessel. So, you know, I was told there was a very good chance that I wouldn't wake up, and I needed to kind of be aware of that, really.
What's it like to be given news like that?
At that point, I think, I just remember thinking, well, there's nothing I can do about this now. And in some small way, I just remember feeling quite grateful that at least they knew what it was now and that they could do something about it. And my thoughts really were mainly with my family, to be honest. I thought they're the ones that are having to watch me go through this, and I have no idea what that must be like. You know, in some way, by then I was so heavily sedated up in hospital that I was, I say I kind of came out of it lightest, but I was least aware of what was going on in a way. You know, I think it was my family that were having the procedures explained to them in detail, but it was shocking. I didn't expect it. I just thought, wow, you know, how's this happened to me? You know, what's gone wrong, sort of thing.
But even in that state, you were wanting to discuss your funeral plans and settle
I
your
did,
affairs.
Yeah. Yeah, a few things sort of came to me, really, that I just felt quite strongly about. I'm quite a sea person. I love swimming in the ocean. I've got a tropical fish tank at home that I just love sitting and staring at. So I knew I wanted to be cremated and sort of scattered out to sea. That was something that was quite important to me.
Now you will hear the recording again.
I just just had this very sudden, sharp shooting pain at the middle of my forehead and a very sort of strange kind of popping sensation behind my eye. The way I've sort of learned to describe it to myself now is really it's like sort of someone squashing a grape just behind my eye. That's exactly kind of what it felt like.
So what did you think had happened?
I didn't know. I just knew that something was, you know, sort of going wrong, really. I've never had a migraine, I don't think, in my life. So not being a migraine sufferer, I don't think I could identify that it wasn't a migraine. So I think that was my initial thought, really, was, oh, blimey, am I having my first, you know, migraine here? Is that what's going on?
How long did you leave it before you went to see a doctor?
Well, I took myself to bed that weekend. This was on the Thursday night that it first happened. And I just remember sort of thinking, oh, I just need to have a few days rest. And I did. But then on the Tuesday, I just kind of thought, oh, pull yourself together, come on, it's only a headache. And I kind of got on with my life, really, for a week.
So you'd been having these terrible headaches for more than a week?
Yeah, in the week itself, when I got back to work, I didn't have any sort of shooting pain headaches, actually. I just felt quite groggy. But yeah, I did a lot that week. I went to the dentist and had injections, actually, in my mouth, which is quite dangerous, I think, with a brain hemorrhage. But I obviously didn't know that I had one at the time. But the following Friday, I had another very bad headache, and that was the kind of the beginning of me really going downhill.
When you went to the doctor, how quickly did they work out that something very serious had happened to you?
Well, when I went to Derby Royal Hospital, I went to A&E, and at that point, I remember I couldn't even sit up. I actually lay on the floor in A&E. A nurse kind of looked at my eye, and that's where the bleed was behind my eye, so it was sort of squashing the nerve behind my right eye, and that was a real sign that something was going on. And they put me straight into a scanner, and then I had an angiogram, which is where they inject lots of dye in you so they can see if any blood's escaping. And then that was it. I was straight into an ambulance up to the neurological ward in Sheffield.
What were you told about your chances of survival?
A lot of doctors came to explain the chances to me that during the operation there was a very, very good chance that I would bleed out and die, that, you know, or that they might not be able to fix it anyway. I think it was one of those operations that they couldn't tell me my chances until they kind of got inside my head, so to speak, to really see, you know, what the bleed was looking like and the shape of this burst blood vessel. So, you know, I was told there was a very good chance that I wouldn't wake up, and I needed to kind of be aware of that, really.
What's it like to be given news like that?
At that point, I think, I just remember thinking, well, there's nothing I can do about this now. And in some small way, I just remember feeling quite grateful that at least they knew what it was now and that they could do something about it. And my thoughts really were mainly with my family, to be honest. I thought they're the ones that are having to watch me go through this, and I have no idea what that must be like. You know, in some way, by then I was so heavily sedated up in hospital that I was, I say I kind of came out of it lightest, but I was least aware of what was going on in a way. You know, I think it was my family that were having the procedures explained to them in detail. But it was shocking. I didn't expect it. I just thought, wow, you know, how's this happened to me? You know, what's gone wrong, sort of thing.
But even in that state, you were wanting to discuss your funeral plans and settle your
affairs. I did, yeah. Yeah, a few things sort of came to me, really, that I just felt quite strongly about. I'm quite a sea person. I love swimming in the ocean. I've got a tropical fish tank at home that I just love sitting and staring at. So I knew I wanted to be cremated and sort of scattered out to sea. That was something that was quite important to me.
This is the end of section B.
Siamo alla conclusione della prova d'ascolto d'inglese. Smettete di scrivere, chiudete la prova d'esame e posatela sull'orlo del banco insieme alla scheda di valutazione.
Ancora un cordiale saluto.